Hi, this is Ryan Hill with Interpretive Programs, and we're doing an in-conversation with Candace Lynn, and she is an artist born in Oregon, lives in Los Angeles. She shows at Chungking Project, and went to school in San Francisco Art Institute and Brown for Fine Arts. And she's a Smithsonian Artist Research Fellow, and part of what we'd like to do is just have a conversation with some of the fellows about what kind of work they make, their opportunity to research at the Smithsonian, and how that might influence their work. So this is an opportunity for us to talk with her about it. So Candace, your work consists of drawings and sculptures and animation, and I'm really interested in artist process, and especially since a lot of the artists who come here as a research fellow, they research as part of their process. So can you tell me a little bit about, first about the relationship between those mediums, how you see them, and then also maybe about how research is part of your process in terms of developing your work?
My primary medium is drawing, and I usually use graphite and watercolor and ink on paper, but sometimes if an idea that I have needs to communicate itself over time in a narrative, then I use animation, and occasionally I make sculpture when the idea needs to be communicated in the form of sculpture.
Okay, great. We're looking at Memento Mori right now, and in this image, how do you start making an image like this? Is there source material that you've researched to start with, or does it evolve?
This image actually came from a photo in The Sexual Life of Savages by Bronislaw Malinowski. The original image is just the figures with more figures in the background. But I was interested in the idea of the jungle as this sort of this screen, this projection site, and how it's gendered also. So in this image, the sort of graphic way it's drawn is supposed to look like pubic hair.
Yeah.
And there's the female figure in the foreground who's actually dead, and her corpse is being held up by two men in the background. And I've inserted this sort of smiley face necklace that she's wearing, which is not in the original photograph, because I was thinking about how the camera and this idea of like smiling is sort of works as this reminder of death in a way.
Oh, interesting.
And so that's why it's called Memento Mori.
Oh, okay. Because I was thinking when I was looking at this, the style that you use has a kind of traditional style that you might think of with like colonial artwork or artwork that's used to document another civilization. So I'm thinking of like engravings that come back with people who explore new countries, or things that are done and in like, you know, 19th century travel journals or things like that. So when I was looking at the style, I think one of the things that kind of made it kind of more ironic or kind of problematized it being more historical looking was the smiley face pendant. So that's also something that it did for me.
Right.
Because there's really nothing to smile about otherwise in this image. So it seems like a little bit of pop art, you know, like, I don't know. So that was an interesting thing that I saw. And I guess that brings up the idea of the style that you're using in your work is very much connected to maybe an older an older style. Can you talk about that and how you came about starting to use that?
Well, I think that the sort of travelogues you were referencing and even ones earlier definitely were a big influence on the way I draw or the way I make things.
So maybe we should look at Regendered Society now.
Okay.
This next drawing, which includes more of a kind of a background and a foreground. So tell me a little bit about that. What first got you interested in making works that kind of looked like you know, something that was like colonial renderings of other cultures, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I'm interested in the... Well, it's not really that on purpose that I'm making them look like colonial narratives. I think it's more like an unconscious influence of things I'm really interested in looking at that's sort of coming through my work.
Uh-huh.
And I think I'm interested in looking at them because they embody so many of these like strange visual sort of problematic representations of race and gender that I find really obsessive in my research. And so when I draw on this style that sort of references that, but use narratives that bring out the violence or bring out things that weren't talked about, it's sort of a way to bring out the things that I find most fascinating about those older imageries.
Yeah. I feel like the figures are not specific people. And we talked a little bit earlier about how you kind of generalize the figure or generalize the features. And in a lot of ways that missionaries may have, you know, generalized native mm-hmm. peoples in their renderings. And so when you do that, it makes me think about kind of how people will generalize other cultures. But also, too, is it also seems like it could be working as a metaphor for something or an allegory of some kind of bigger thing.
Well, I actually was curious about that idea of generalizing because... In some ways, I think it's less about generalizing than it is about projection. Like, if you look at a lot of the earlier engravings from the 1500s and the 1600s, there are the features of the indigenous people are very white and also masculine. Like, the women's bodies look like men's bodies with breasts that are just sort of, like, oddly stuck on in the wrong places. So I was interested in not just the idea of generalizing, but also the idea of projection, of not being able to escape where you're coming from.
Yeah.
That gets into the representation that you're making as an artist.
So it's like cultural bias. Mm-hmm. Like you can't envision another difference, another person's difference.
And also, maybe more in this, can we move on to the next
one? Yeah. We're now looking at Birth of a Nation, and this is a little bit different in that you're using more of, it looks like a watercolor?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is actually all watercolor and ink. And what I was going to say was that I, more recently, I've been thinking about this sort of complication of race and it being an invention in itself and trying to show that by having, instead of it being really clear in the features, like these are white people and these are not, that it's problematized here. Like in the foreground, you can see the figures that are supposedly maybe white figures, but maybe they're not really white people.
But they're kind of half and half. Like some of them have maybe darker skin tone on their heads, but then their bodies might be more white or...
Mm-hmm. Or the nose is like a big indicator of race, and the noses are all like kind of, I don't know, ambiguous in a way.
Yeah.
So I was trying to more recently bring up ambiguity of race and even ambiguity of gender to question the idea that there are these separate races and just two sexes, which are both, I think, very invented sort of constructions.
So now when you say they're invented constructions, we're talking about things that a lot of people think and are secure in, like the idea of someone has a specific gender and someone has specific ethnicity.
Right.
But in your drawings, you're kind of playing around with that.
Yeah, like a lot of these figures are actually, if you look at their genitalia, it's ambiguous.
Uh-huh. Interesting. And so that, to me, that's an interesting thing, which is you're using... a style that might be more historic looking, might look like a document from another time period of another race, but then you're making it more, you've been using the word problematizing a lot. When you get to making your more sculptural work, are there different issues you grapple with, or do you feel like it comes out of the same exploration?
It comes out of the same exploration, but...
And this one's called Objects of Magical Import.
Yeah, I think I primarily, because I think so much in narrative, I think usually in terms of drawings, but occasionally I'll have an idea like this one that just, if there's no way it could be a drawing. And my idea, I was looking at minkisis, those objects that are made that are sort of these metaphors in the objects that they use. And then I was also thinking about amateur ethnographic displays and also trade blankets with goods for sale.
Oh, uh-huh.
So,
like, the way, I don't know a lot about anthropology, so when I think of trade blankets, I think of, like, when people have yard sales, they might spread out mm-hmm. a blanket and then they have the objects there.
Right, yeah, similar uh-huh. kind of idea, except I'm trying to talk more about, like, obviously colonial trade and the sort of things that happen within that sort of first contact moment.
Huh.
So a lot of these things reference, like, this is a, you can't really see it in this picture, but on the far right in the middle, there's an object that looks like a gun that's made out of a PVC pipe, part of a lizard from one of those Chinese herbal stores.
Oh, really? Cool.
And an antler bone. And
yeah, that's what struck me in a lot of these objects. If we, when we can look at them really a lot closer,
mm-hmm.
You can see that they're everyday. They're everyday objects mm-hmm. combined with things from nature.
Mm-hmm. Right, and I was interested a lot in the sort of syncretic moments in culture where things are fused and show each other's influence on each other.
Uh-huh.
So, and then this object also is supposed to reference photography, and it's sort of a magical object that is used to kill or injure your enemy.
Uh-huh. Now the tags that are on them, because these look like the kind of labeling or categorizing that, you know, an institution like the Smithsonian might do, or any institution that has mm-hmm. that you know, needs to do an inventory of their artifacts. These labels, it's hard to tell, are these labels clarifying what these objects are?
In some ways, I think that the labels are clarifying the objects, but they're also complicating them.
Mm-hmm.
Like the label that's attached to the object that has all the bottles with liquid in it
uh-huh.
Talks about, it has a quote about taking samples of urine from the Yanomami Indian women.
Uh-huh.
And it's a really funny quote. I can't remember it exactly now, but it's about the beautiful ambers and yellows. It's talking about the piss as if it's this, like, really rarefied object.
Uh-huh.
And then there was a later description in a different book that was talking about blood, fecal, and urine samples, and how some of the beautiful ambers and yellows might have been from the fact that these women were terrified and were trying, like, to hide and not use the bathroom because they didn't want their urine taken, so it took on, like, a really concentrated color.
Oh, weird. So,
yeah, from,
so, and these are all, so you have found these in, like, texts from anthropologists?
Yeah, from my research.
And so from your research, these are things all based on research, but you're kind of manifesting them in objects.
Mm-hmm.
But the weird thing about what you're talking about is also the language that
uses.
These objects,
yeah.
use, and how it seems to be both about kind of pleasure. And you've talked about the power dynamics you feel that are in your work about powers that have that in terms of, like, racial dynamics or gender dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like that's operating also in these works too, I guess?
Yeah, definitely.
Do you, I mean, this is kind of off kind of the top of my head in a funny way, but so what role does the viewer occupy when they look at your work? I mean, do you think of the viewers looking at the work for pleasure, or a scientific inquiry, like an anthropologist, or?
Well, I want to make the viewer really aware when they're looking at it of the sort of discomfort and the sort of pleasure they might be getting, and I think that you become aware of your pleasure by feeling your discomfort, and you become aware of your discomfort also by feeling your pleasure.
Uh-huh.
It's like the sort of, like, give take. So I think that my work tries to ride the line between, you know, being this sort of attractive image in a way that's either attractive because it's exotic or sensationalized, or, you know, has some aspect that is attractive, but then crosses over the line and is, like, uncomfortable, maybe too familiar, or just speaks of the violence or something that is not comfortable,
uh-huh.
obviously.
So you've been researching at the Smithsonian. Can you tell us what institutions that you've been working with?
I've been spending a lot of time at the Coleman Library and the National Anthropological Archives out in Maryland.
Okay. Uh-huh. Just those two places?
No, I've gone to a bunch of the other libraries too. I found some really interesting books actually at the African Art Library that it seems like hardly anyone goes into that library, but they have a lot of really neat books.
So what kinds of things are you finding that you are interested in?
It's like all over the place. The Coleman I wanted to look at some of the old Theodore de Bry travelogues.
Uh-huh.
So I started with that, and it was really amazing to get to see those original books.
Uh-huh.
And then I think that as I started to look at some of the displays at the Smithsonian and shape some of my ideas for artworks I wanted to make, my focus sort of shifted and I started to think more about displays and authenticity and some of the research I was doing on Franz Boas, who was part of my original proposal,
uh-huh.
also related to displays, and so.
So you're looking at documents, but you're also looking at displays. So how cultures are displayed at the Smithsonian?
No, I'm not. I'm sorry. I might have said that wrong. I'm more looking at the history sort of ethnographic displays and how that shapes our understanding of race.
Okay.
So
not you don't really looking at anything the Smithsonian is doing as much as documents the Smithsonian has about ways things have been displayed in the past.
Yeah, but
okay.
But because I was looking at the stuff about Franz Boas, then I happened to go and look at some of the actual current displays, like at the one at the NMAI, what's it called? Our Voices.
Uh-huh.
The contemporary and also the African Voices exhibit at the Natural History Museum.
Uh-huh,
I thought those were both really fascinating.
What was fascinating about them?
There's this one exhibit in the African Voices that I'm completely mesmerized by. It's the right when you walk in, there's the Somali house. What's it called? The Akal.
Uh-huh.
And then next to the traditional Akal, there's this human-sized video projection of a Somali American man and a Somali American woman. They kind of interchange,
uh-huh.
Speaking about their memories in Somali, uh-huh. growing up in an Akal. And it has this weird sci-fi effect on you when you walk in. You see this like life-size figure sort of floating in and appearing, like in Star Trek,
uh-huh.
and speaking to you. And to me, it brought up all these interesting ideas about authenticity,
uh-huh.
and self-representation. And then they're dressed in very, like, middle-class American clothing, or, you know,
uh-huh.
like he's dressed very nicely. And there's a curtain in the back to make it very neutral.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know, I thought it was fascinating.
And in terms of authenticity, that's an interesting thing to ask, because mm-hmm. the Smithsonian uses artifacts and documents and has all of this to validate the authenticity of these things. So
mm-hmm.
is there something being problematized for you, or what do you mean by authenticity?
Well, I think it's not necessarily how the Smithsonian's doing it that problematizes it for me. I think the idea of authenticity in general is problematic for me.
Huh.
Because it's, on the one hand, it's supposedly trying to correct maybe a history that's been misrepresented in the past,
like, uh-huh.
but it's also, I think, in its nature of being this idea of authenticity, it's sort of a problem in itself. Like, it's like, oh, it wasn't like that, it's like this.
Uh-huh.
And then it becomes this very possessable, concrete thing that's very limited in a different way, you know?
Huh.
So I think authenticity as an idea is just really problematic, and it's, for me, evident in those displays, like, how it becomes problematic, like,
huh.
the limits of self-representation.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's interesting also, too, about the Smithsonian Artist Research Fellowship is that you start off with a research project, and then you end up kind of going in a different direction, but also, too, that an artist is looking. I mean, there's also, I think, what artists give in this program back to the Smithsonian is interesting, too, because you have an artist take mm-hmm. on disciplines that aren't necessarily in their expertise, but at the same time, their take is a very unique take, and they bring kind of new ideas to looking at these displays, like you've done. So, but in terms of your research, what will you take back into your practice?
Well,
I mean, it's hard to say right now, because part of the idea, I think, is that the fellowship allows you, you don't have to make work, you just get to research, but...
Right. I actually have a lot of ideas for work I want to make. That display I was telling you about is going to be part of a video I want to make that I've actually already had started making part of the animation before.
Uh-huh.
So it's going to be animation with live video that's has these different sorts of narratives imposed on top of it.
Uh-huh.
And then I had a lot of ideas for drawings and maybe some etchings that I wanted to make from the images I saw in some of the older books.
Great.
So, yeah.
Did the research ever bump you into kind of any surprises or discoveries in terms of new ways you'd want to go in your work?
It was interesting because I became really aware of myself positioned as a researcher because I started looking for specific things and then I would think I was finding them and then I would find out that they weren't them.
Uh-huh.
This happened a couple times. One was really interesting. I thought that I had found these pictures of the damage done during slave revolts in Haiti that were part of the stereoscopic collection at the Archives of American History.
Uh-huh.
And I was so excited because they were labeled really vaguely, like disaster, West Indies, or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And then it turned out that they were actually images of the ruins after the eruption of Mount Pelee in Martinique.
Oh.
So I became hyper aware of my position as a researcher, and I kind of want to bring that into my artwork in a way.
Because
like,
you were looking for certain kind of material,
yeah.
and you think you'd find it.
Mm-hmm.
But
So in a way, I was sort of paralleling what I'm talking about subject-wise in my work, so I'd like to bring my own sort of slippage of that, you know, that position into the work more.
Oh, that's cool.
But I don't know quite yet how that will be.
But that's an experience that
yeah.
probably, you know, has helped your work in a certain way. Maybe
yeah.
even asking you to be more self-reflective in a certain
yeah,
sort of way.
Definitely.
Yeah. Anything else you want to say about the program or anything that surprised you or came up?
Not really. I'm just glad I was able to have this opportunity.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for talking with us. And I look forward to seeing what comes out of all this. So
great. Thank
you. Thank you.